If you imagine a company has a $10 million marketing budget, right? Mm-hmm. And then you imagine they have a Sonic logo on every single TikTok ad, Facebook ad, YouTube ad, all these new medias where the majority of the traffic's coming from now. If they can increase conversion rates marginally, that can have a huge difference to their bottom line. And it's one of those things where, because Sonic branding, once it's done once and well, yes, there might be a brand refresh where it's changed in 10 years, or it's updated, or maybe it's changed slightly to work with a different culture, right? There might be like a slightly version which sounds more Canadian, right? Or more Christmassy or things like that. But the point being is, this is an asset that they develop once, and then it can be used on these campaigns that can have huge advertising budgets, which makes it very cheap when you compare it to the actual campaign marketing spend.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Dr. Thomas Dixon. My next guest is a musicologist specializing in how we perceive sound and how it shapes brand communication. Pretty perfect for what we usually discuss around here. With a PhD in music psychology, he helps brands create emotionally resonant, research-backed sonic identities. His work reduces subjectivity, improves creative decisions, and even addresses legal risks like plagiarism and audio branding. His name is Dr. Thomas Dixon. He's advised national retailers, tech firms, and service brands. And as if the subject of musicology isn't fascinating enough, I'm excited to also discuss how businesses can make sure their sound stays original and protected. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. And now, here's my conversation with Dr. Thomas Dixon. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Thomas. I really appreciate you making the time, especially considering our time zone difference.
Yeah, thank you, Jody. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks. I'm amazed at what the internet makes possible, because you are in Australia right now, right?
Yes. Yep.
Whereabouts in Australia?
Southeast Queensland.
Okay, great. Have you always lived there?
Yeah.
Or? Oh, 7 a.m.
Yeah, it's a nice early start.
Yeah. Have you always lived there, or have you traveled at all?
Alternated between there and Melbourne. So I always lived in Australia. But Australia is huge. I mean, you're in Canada, so you understand how big some of these.
Yeah.
Much of Europe could fit in Australia. So
probably.
And much of the US can fit in Australia too, the USA.
Very true. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm really glad that you were able to join us today. So thank you for that. And when we start these discussions, I always like to ask my guest if you could tell me a story of an early memory of how sound moved you.
Yes. So I prepared for this because I know this is something that you often ask. So I've got a story that came from about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I went and saw the Melbourne Symphonic Orchestra play Sibelius's Second Symphony. Are you familiar with that piece?
Not off the top of my head, the name of it.
Familiar with
Sibelius? If I heard it, I probably would recognize it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in any way, it was an outdoor concert. And I was alone, it was cold, it was windy, and it was dark, right? So it's this really like broody, moody kind of outdoor atmosphere. Now, the cool thing about this is Sibelius is Finnish, and this is a nationalistic work. So he was trying to represent the landscape of Finland by having these like really cold kind of melodies and wavering kind of things going on. And there I was out there at the Melbourne Symphonic Orchestra in the cold, in this like really windy environment, and it was really congruent. It's like the music mirrored the experience. And so anyway, we get into the fourth movement. This is the finale. And there's a repetitive bridge section. And this repetitive bridge section is just going again and again. And it's just this ostinato that just goes on loop and on loop. Anyway, at that moment, it starts to rain. So we're out there in the concert and it's just starting to pitter down and patter down just a little bit, going on and just again in that monotonous kind of joining with the music. Anyway, by the grand finale, it's bucketing down raining and everyone's still there. So we've got this, you know, this huge event. It's bucketing down raining. No one's leaving because they want to hear the finale. And then, of course, after the finale ends, there's no applause. Everyone just runs to the tram and goes home.
Oh, wow. Right?
But what was really special about that experience was that the way that it mirrored, the music mirrored the actual, like,
the environment
that was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty
so
awesome.
It was really.
How old were you when that happened?
I would have been 21, 22.
Okay.
So 10 years
okay.
ago. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it was a while ago, but the reason I wanted to tell you this story is it's actually just an excuse for me to talk about musicology. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk with you through this model of emotion, which is called the BRECVEM model, and how that relates to this experience that I went through.
Can I just ask you to define musicology just before we get into this? Because there are a lot of, I myself probably don't know the full definition. So if you can explain what that actually is, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So I should have said up the front, I'm a musicologist.
Yes.
So that means that I have a doctorate in music. What we're looking at there is musicology is like the academic and rigorous study of music. It comes under a broad range of different styles. Mm-hmm. So this could be like music history. It could be music psychology, which is what I looked at, the psychology of music or sound. It could be ethnomusicology, looking at the history of music, ethnographies around music. And it also can look at performance and understanding, you know, techniques and things like that, which could include, you know, posture and ergonomic work related to music. So it's really this rigorous academic view of music where you'd be writing articles, publishing papers, and having very strenuous approaches to how you measure results.
And how did
in
regards
to your studies.
Get into that? Because, I mean,
it's
got to be an interesting progression. I'm assuming you were a musician.
Yes.
And then you decided to take it to the nth degree.
So for me, I've always been passionate about why music makes me feel a certain way. I've been very interested in like why I can read literature or watch a movie and not really feel it. But when it comes to music, I immediately, you know, very emotional. It has a lot of strong effect on me. So my background is in music composition. So I did an undergrad in music composition and then did honors in music composition. And from that, I was able to do a doctorate continuing on the course, and that was through the University of Melbourne.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and then, University of New South Wales.
Oh, yeah. I mean, fantastic. Did you ever make your living as a musician at any point or?
No. So I was on a stipend during that program.
Okay.
So, you know, university funding.
Yeah.
And in additional, and this relates to what we're going to talk about today, which will relate to, you know, sonic branding and things like that. I've supplemented my work with doing digital marketing. So I understand the atmosphere of like marketing, the online ecosystem.
Yeah, wonderful. So the experience that you had in that audience, are you relating that then to sonic branding? Is that?
No, so I'm going to relate it to just to give a framework of emotion.
Okay.
So there's a framework of emotion, music and emotion, which is the BRECVEM. And what we're going to do now is I'm just going to look at all the pieces of this and how we can understand it from an emotion perspective using the literature. So the first one was musical expectancy. So during that piece of music, I mentioned I was put into a trance-like state. And what I mean by that is that we had an expectation that the music would change. Because it always violated that expectation, you end up going into a lull. Because you're constantly expecting this change to happen and it never happens. And that's what drives the this sense of trance-like. The second thing that was going on was visual imagery. So visual imagery is where you listen to a piece of music and then it conjures up an image, right? I imagine this tundra of cold and wind and snow and all that kind of stuff. And that was another way for me to experience the emotion that I was feeling at that time. And then this is the one that relates to, then there was evaluative conditioning, which is where you pair music with a stimulus. In this case, the stimulus was the rain, the cold, the weather, the wind, right? That heightened the experience. And because I was out there getting bucketed on with rain, it's a pretty strong experience. So therefore, the way that I evaluate that music later has a stronger, a stronger emotional impact there. And finally, related to sonic branding, there's this thing called episodic memory. And what we're talking about here is we had a serious episode that happened with music. And now when we experience that music again, we are immediately taken back to that experience. And that's really important to brands because they want that kind of thing of if they say, for example, played at FIFA or something like that, and it's a really key important moment, every time that piece of music is heard, the positive associations that they had with that experience will be carried over to their music.
Yeah, very true. And I've had multiple discussions with many people about that particular topic, and consistent repetition over a long period of time basically associates that sound with that business. So
yes.
Yeah, it becomes a memory thing. And again, almost a time travel thing, because you hear that sound and it takes you immediately back to that moment you first heard it and what you were feeling in that moment and how it made you feel and all of that. And so, yeah, it's very big in audio branding. But how does musicology...
A lot of this stuff, all of this stuff comes from musicology literature. So that was a framework that was developed in the 2000s. And so by understanding that framework, then we can look at how we want to tailor the music to shape those experiences. It's very common for people to talk about music and emotion, but not actually to be familiar with the mechanisms by which music conveys emotion. So by going through those, that was five of the seven emotions, mechanisms by which music can convey emotion, we can help, musicians, composers, and things like that get those outcomes that they desire.
Hi there, I'm Carsten Kims, CEO and founder of Sunny Minds, and you're listening to the Audio Branding Podcast, a great place to learn about how powerful sound can be. If you want to understand how to harness the power in your own life, keep listening.
So is this something you've mentioned, an audio brand tone of voice?
Does
that relate back to what you're talking about with those different emotions or?
No, that's more based on a cultural phenomenon.
Okay.
So you could say that what you're saying, like what you said there about like the pairing of music and sound, mm-hmm. throughout history, we've paired certain sounds with certain emotions and certain, branding outcomes. So like we might have, we want to convey trust. So maybe we have a strong triumphant, trumpet. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of tropes that we'd expect, the lonely oboe. Right. We might have an acoustic guitar over the campfire. These are kind of cultural norms that come from all around the world and throughout history that we now associate with sounds. So this audio tone of voice worksheet, what it looks at is we have these certain branding pillars that we might have. So it might be innovation, trust, and let's say Australiana, right? So we go, innovation, we have cultural norms associated with electronic music, digital sounds, hard-hitting bass, all that kind of stuff that we associate with that through repeated exposure mm-hmm. with these sounds, with those kind of branding pillars. And then we might have trust, which I mentioned before. And then Australiana, that might be like a didgeridoo using a cultural
norm. I was going to say, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what I would associate with it,
right?
But yeah. What do I know though?
So with when I'm working with clients and I give them that audio tone of voice worksheet, they can say from a branding perspective whether they want to be, let's say, more innovative or more traditional. And then from that, we can look at what cultural musical norms are associated with those and write music that aligns with that.
I see. Okay. So musicology and audio branding, they go together with this framework that you're talking about, or
musicology covers so much. It really can be used at the beginning before the audio branding starts, during the audio branding, and also afterwards to test audio branding. it's really just about bringing an extra level of rigor and strategy to your sonic branding project.
I see. Okay. So have you used this for any particular clients that you are really proud of? Is there a particular brand?
There's only really one client that I can talk about right now because most of them are under NDA.
And
that's there's an Australian client, and that's an internet provider called TPG. Yeah, and they're Australia wide, and so I worked with them to identify where they could stand out from competitors, and so did a competitor analysis, and then figured out where the gaps were, both culturally and musically, and then how they could use that in their sonic logo.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So we also were talking about plagiarism in audio branding, because I know you did a whole paper on that, and it's a fascinating topic that honestly didn't even occur to me. So can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. So off the bat, I have to say straight up, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a musicologist.
Yes.
So the lens at which we're looking this through is through music norms, and through the music court case systems, but consult your lawyer before you make any musical decisions based on what I talk about today. So going back to when I'm usually brought in, so I work with sonic branding agencies, and typically most of them just want to stay on the tools. They're interested in music, they just want to stay on the tools. They want to bring in an expert to help them with the strategy, to work with clients, and to measure results. I was working with one agency in Australia, and they were getting quite concerned about some of the music court cases that are going on at the moment. There's been quite a few that have gotten really big, quite expensive, and quite convoluted. So the most recent one is Miley Cyrus and Bruno Mars, which I think started last year. And they're just seeing more and more of these court cases pop up. So they reached out to me and said, hey, could you do some research on this so that we can have a strategy for when we work with clients so that we don't end up accidentally getting sued?
That's a big one.
Yeah, yeah. So there hasn't been any music plagiarism court cases yet related to sonic branding. But because of the way we do sonic branding, we're actually, it's quite a, it leans itself towards more risk than pop songs. So there's two reasons. One is because when we look at these mnemonics, often we want to make them short, catchy, memorable. So you imagine there's all the musical decisions that we could choose from, but instead we tend to go to a 5 to 7 note pentatonic scale with an uplift at the end or a resolution at the end. And when you look at that, you go, well, there's not really as many musical decisions as there might be in an entire pop song. So that puts it at a bit of risk. And particularly people want it to be memorable. So they want it to be really catchy, strong melodies. So that's the first part. And then the second part is we often base our sonic branding off temp tracks. So a temp track or a sonic mood board is a toolkit where you talk to the client and you would say something like, okay, here's your brand values. Here are 30 pieces that aren't composed by us that align with your strategy. Tell us what you think about these pieces and if there's any gaps there or if we're misrepresenting your music based on the brief. So they'd go through all the tracks and then they might say, oh, we really like this Taylor Swift song, right? They've decided that that's like, that seems to be quite similar in style to what they want. The issue is that sometimes the clients fall in love with these temp tracks or this sonic branding and they call it temp love. And what can be really challenging for sonic branding agencies is they're really creative people, but they're concerned that the client wants them to sound more like Taylor Swift in this example. And they don't want to go too far away from the brief, but they don't want to be too similar to the Taylor Swift song because then they could be at risk of getting sued. So this is just a little bit of a quirk in sonic branding where those audio mood boards or sonic mood boards or temp tracks are really key to getting a good strategy and saving time. Because the last thing you want to do is compose something that doesn't really suit the brief that you thought did. But you also don't want to end up with something that's derivative of another work.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. And there's a definite danger there. I know that when it comes to advertising, a lot of companies will put on a temp track on their ad and then from wherever, I don't know, and then fall in love with it. And then the whole, it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see how the danger would be there. Mm. But how can a business, a brand protect themselves then?
Mm. So the first thing is having a conversation with the clients. You know, just telling them, look, these are the risks that are involved. This is a possible scenario that would be quite concerning if it did happen. Imagine you're a brand, you've got an end of year sale, end of financial year sale, and then someone comes in and puts a cease and desist order on your music because it's too similar to the music that, you know, is owned by someone else. And now you can't use that music for your campaign anymore. And you're in the middle of a sale, right? Something like that would freak out brands. And it's a good example of how you could just say, look, these are some of the risks that can happen, which is why we need to put budget, time, and effort towards having a strategy. So that's the first thing. Talk with your clients. Second thing is we can look at the existing court cases and some of the faults and gaps in those court cases to see where the wiggle room is. So when we look at traditional music court cases, what we see is that most of them come from a classical music lens. So they're looking at melody, pitch, and so they're probably looking at like melody, with vocal melodies or rhythmic, or ostinatos. And then they're looking at note placement in those melodies and also looking at pitch information, contours, things like that. There is so much more to music than melody. And this is where a composer could work in those areas and be at a lower risk than directly ripping off a melody. So you go back to your Taylor Swift example, maybe they take similar instrumentation, similar arrangements, similar effects on the instrumentation. The textures might be similar. They might have a similar tempo, similar rhythm, but because the contour of the melody is very different to that Taylor Swift piece of music, there's a lower risk of being taken to court because most of the court cases have been based around melodic pitch information.
Interesting. Okay. So if a brand decided that they wanted to, like I've seen a lot of brands doing this in recent years, taking bits and pieces of their actual product, making sound from it and putting it into their logo, would that help their case?
It depends because like you can...
I mean, the tune would still be the same, maybe. I don't know.
That's what I mean. Like, because, you can sample something, map it to a MIDI keyboard, mm-hmm. and then play Taylor Swift with your can of Coke opening, right? which is cool. And I do encourage brands to do that because to use sounds from the industry because mm-hmm. it creates an immediate shortcut for the client. So let's say... there was a sport that I was going to mention, but I won't mention that client, so I'll choose another sport. Let's say tennis, all right?
Okay, yeah.
So the sound of a tennis ball being whacked, right? If you hear that and it's joined with a kick drum or a bass sound, unconsciously, the listener will be associating your Sonic logo with tennis, which is a nice little shortcut. And in addition to that, because you don't hear people using tennis racket hitting sounds inside pop songs, it's going to be distinctive from pop music. So you also have a more distinctive asset, which is great.
Yeah.
But yeah, to answer your question, the first place that they really want to focus on is just making sure that the melody is very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the rhythmic ostinatos. Yeah.
I could see how that would be hard. there's a lot out there that's already been done. So yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
I know, for instance, Tostitos did this with their chips. So they took the sounds of the bag or the crunch of the chips or the opening of a salsa jar, you know, like all of this kind of stuff, and put it into their logo, which was really interesting. And I think Kia did the same thing with their cars. They had people playing the car as an instrument, which was really interesting.
There was a really good example you might remember. I think it was the London Olympics, mm-hmm. where they took all the sounds of all the different sports and put them into a musical track. The thing I would say though is there are risks being too dependent on sound design. Sound design isn't a particularly good strategy to convey emotion, right? If we think of the sound of a tennis racket, hitting a ball, that's not going to have much emotion conveyed in it. Whereas if you are to pitch tune that, so make it turn into a melody or add a melody over the top and use that as rhythm, then there's opportunity to get both the distinctive asset and also an opportunity to convey, music and emotion using the tools that have, melody and things like that.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating stuff. And so many things that could go on in a audio brand. Because I read your PDF, I noticed that you put in there that a lot more people are doing sonic branding these days.
Yeah.
Audio branding. Yeah. So yeah, that's encouraging. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, it keeps me busy.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's one of those things where the more agencies I talk to, many of them come from composing music for advertisements, mm-hmm. and their clients are saying, hey, you do our music for advertising, for our TV commercials, for our radio, things like that. And they'll say, well, why don't you do a sonic branding? And a lot of these agencies are like, that's fantastic, but I don't have a clue what I'm doing with sonic branding. So they end up just treating it like an advertisement. And that's where typically I'd be brought in, where people are unsure of the strategy that's involved and unsure how to speak the language of branding and also the musicology, and being able to provide confidence to the clients by having that musicology background testing, or whether that's looking through the literature, the music literature, it can provide confidence to those brand managers to making sure that they're getting an asset that can last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely the idea. I mean, I assume that these are pretty expensive things to do, so you don't want to just do a one-off and have it run through one advertising campaign and then have it disappear.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is the case. But I do think, and as sonic branding agencies, we haven't done a particularly good job of demonstrating how actually cheap it is.
Oh, okay.
So what I mean by that is... if you imagine a company has a $10 million marketing budget, right? Mm-hmm. And then you imagine they have a sonic logo on every single TikTok ad, Facebook ad, YouTube ad, all these new medias where the majority of the traffic's coming from now. If they can increase conversion rates marginally, that can have a huge difference to their bottom line. And it's one of those things where, because sonic branding, once it's done once and well, yes, there might be a brand refresh where it's changed in 10 years, or it's updated, or maybe it's changed slightly to work with a different culture, right? There might be like a slightly version which sounds more Canadian, right? Or more Christmassy, or things like that. But the point being is, this is an asset that they develop once, and then it can be used on these campaigns that can have huge advertising budgets, which makes it very cheap when you compare it to the actual campaign marketing spend.
Oh, yeah. And I know people used to spend a lot of money on license-free music directory stuff. So, I mean, even then, the issue that I've always had with that, though, is that your nearest competitor could use the same song that you use. Which I'm sure has happened multiple times.
Yeah, and that can really backfire. Particularly, there's a classic example of a British company, which is like a high-end Home Depot, kitchen renovations, and they used a song that was also used in the Godzilla trailer. And it's one of those things at the same time, you could be watching a trailer for Godzilla and also hear this piece of music. Now, yes, it was rearranged so that it was like, that Hans Zimmer epic music trailer that they had with the Godzilla, but it was Welcome to My World was the track. But that's terrible for branding.
Yeah, it's terrible to have your home hardware place associated with Godzilla, really.
Yeah.
I mean, not great.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I have witnessed the phenomenon of different advertising using the same song for like multiple different industries. So anything from a car company to a gardening company to a food item, and then a shoe, you know, like, and they're all using that same sound. Oh, one of them was a fast food place. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it just gets ridiculous.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.